we are all about sharing new ideas at The Shift Extension. But why not share a cup of coffee? That creamy little cup of magic that just makes everything better. I love coffee, so I've been roasting fresh beans right here in Brisbane, and I'd love to share them with you. So we've created two great flavors to fuel your next shift. If you're a member of our Patreon, we'll give you 20% off any order. So head over to www.shiftycoffee.com.au and grab your first bag today.
Welcome to the paramedic podcast known as the
Shift Extension.
Paramedic podcast.
Oh, you're supposed to say I'm your host, Luke. Oh.
Say it again.
Do it again.
Welcome to the paramedic podcast known as the
Shift Extension.
Hi, I'm Lou.
No!
God.
Lou!
Wait, what am I supposed to say?
I am your host, Lou. Oh.
I am your host, Lou.
Okay, let's go one more time.
And this is...
Three's a charm. Three's a charm.
We need a clapperboard. We never got the clapperboard.
Go. Welcome to the Shift Extension podcast. I'm your host, Lou, and we have Nick and Sunny with us today.
Hey, we got it right.
That was such a good introduction.
Fish on, boys. Let's go.
Fish on. Let's go fishing. Let's do a podcast episode
while we're
fishing.
Absolutely.
I'd be so game. Then we could get a boat, tax write-off.
I know someone that will come with us.
A company boat. We could do it with Wardy.
I'm not going to let you digress.
Who's doing it?
We got a letter.
We got a letter.
We now, all got a letter.
When I say a letter... We didn't get an email.
No. A letter. A handwritten letter with ink and paper.
Not
and
only
it was
that.
Sealed.
And a wax seal.
A wax seal.
Is what? That what that is?
Yeah, yeah, it's wax. You melt it.
But can't you just lick an envelope?
After COVID, you can't lick things anymore.
Yeah, it's frowned upon.
Okay, I know you love to lick a window occasionally.
That is a wax seal.
Absolutely.
You know what? In 2025, when was the last time you got a handwritten letter?
Anything that comes in my mailbox is from Temu or eBay.
Or the bank saying, pay us.
I get them all online.
Or your interest rate's gone up.
I don't think I've had a letter in years, Lou.
No, me either.
A handwritten letter?
Three.
It's so good.
Four?
Well, there was one letter to all of us and then an individual letter to each of us. Which I think is just fantastic. This was from a listener. We'll keep them anonymous. But for that listener, we are incredibly appreciative of the time.
We're going
to
have to give anonymous a name.
What about something like Hernandez?
Hernandez. Jesus.
Let's just go with Henry.
Henry.
No, that's so plain Jane.
I love the name.
Apologies. What's the most interesting name?
Apologies to all the
Henrys. My nephew's name is Frank. Franklin. Frank.
Is that Frankly a person or a pet?
He's a boy.
I ask this because our neighbor's dog is Franklin.
Oh.
That's a good name.
Like Frank the turtle. Franklin the turtle.
Never seen her.
What about, what's a name that's both male and female?
Luca.
Luca, done.
Alrighty.
So Luca sent us, Luca?
Yes.
Luca.
My name is Luca.
Is that a song?
Yep.
Actually,
do you want me to sing it?
Here you go.
I live on the second floor.
Here you go.
I can't remember.
That's not even enough to Shazam. No idea what song this is.
My
the
name
listeners
is Luca.
Will know.
What's this? Is the song called Luca?
I believe so.
Luca.
Everyone knows this song.
Luca.
When does it say Luca? You were just pointing like...
I thought it was going to play. My name is Luca.
It doesn't even fit the song.
What about we give him another name?
No, I like
no, Luca. No. Work with
oh
me
my
here.
God.
Work with me here. Oh, this is a good one.
Stacey.
Okay. Their name is Laura. Laura, like a
Laura. What a banger.
I can get into this.
Thank you, Vaudeville Smash, a
what
Melbourne band.
A banger.
They have some good music. I'll play another song near the end.
Yeah.
What did Laura say?
Dear Lou, Sunny, and Nick. I hope this letter finds you well. I'm writing to you as an avid listener of your incredible podcast and a next-gen paramedic seeking your wisdom and may found amongst your collective knowledge and experience. He's a really nice person.
Mm.
Or she is.
She.
Who knows? Your podcast represents a clear and refreshing presentation of the present and future of paramedicine in Australia. Refreshing. Do you think we're refreshing?
Look, I've listened to a lot of podcasts, Nick, and I know that ours is different because so many of them are focused on the clinical aspects of things, and that's an important part of the job. But I also feel like we're over-educating in the clinical space. We're not talking about the other stuff that we do, and I think there are some people who respond.
Oh,
the conference.
Oh, when's that happening?
Respond positively to some of our conversations because they are sometimes less clinical but still professional in nature of the job.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I would agree.
There would also be people who hate what we do, but mm-hmm. That's okay.
That's a good thing.
That is.
Haters gonna hate.
It's healthy.
We got a letter from someone who likes what we do.
But Laura went on to ask questions of each of us. They said, in this letter, I have decided to address a short question or query or idea to each of you, hoping to gain some insights and information by your individual experiences. Thank you for your servantship in providing an incredible podcast.
It's quite nice.
Mm.
Thanks, Laura. So today we're going to talk about each of these three questions. So, Sunny, let's start with you. What did Laura have for you?
Oh, I've got the letter in front of me to give a background of Laura. They have come from a non-clinical professional background that looked like it was involved in some kind of field work. They're now looking to merge some of their clinical training with what they used to do previously as a way of making their job just that little bit more dynamic. They obviously recognize that we are huge advocates for paramedics don't only work in the ambulance. We are advocates for paramedics also work in ambulances but also work well outside of the truck. There's a question here, there's actually a couple, but there is a theme of a question here around them still being a student, wanting to work in this space and offering their services to go with some field crews as the designated medic, but they're unsure if they're allowed to take on that responsibility. Now, there's an irony to this question because I think there's a little bit of confusion sometimes in our profession, both from the next generation and from the established paramedics, because let's face it, so many of the established paramedics have come from ambulance backgrounds.
Mm.
That's where 99% of our current university educators are working or have worked. And if that's been their only experience, they couldn't possibly understand the ramifications of working as an individual medic in quotation marks, in the private sector or outside of the truck or outside of an ambulance. So I think there's sometimes a lot of overthought here. And I say that because I'm a registered paramedic. I can take my clinical skills into just about any environment I want to. It does get a little bit more challenging when you're working as a registered paramedic without a clinical authority above you, but it is possible, no different to a registered nurse can work just about anywhere as well. We're talking about schools, we're talking about resources, we're talking about expeditions, we're talking about humanitarian deployments. You can take those clinical skills anywhere, but the essence of what I gained from his question is, you know, there's a lot of professions working in the field. You know, there's council teams working in the field, there's schools working in the field, there are research departments, both government and non-government working in the field, and they're essentially asking what the legalities are around them being a student paramedic offering their clinical services in quotation marks to these people operating in that environment. And my answer is probably oversimplified, but in any of these field teams that are out working, they all have designated first aiders. Mm. It's actually a legal responsibility of those organizations to have designated first aiders. And I've worked as a first aider before. Here's the irony. A registered paramedic can't work as a first aider unless you have a valid first aid certificate. And it's actually funny, I'll digress for a second, because there's a lot of ego and arrogance in paramed that I'm bigger than this and I don't need a first aid certificate. But what makes you a paramedic is often the gear you're carrying. Shouldn't, but it is.
But just because you're a paramedic doesn't mean you can be employed as another healthcare.
No, first aid is a completely different industry.
Mm-hmm.
It's not paramed, it's not nursing, it's first aid. So I've always just kept my first aid up to date. And, you know, every single time I attend a first aid course, this is even with 15 years of clinical experience, I've always learned something, whether it be from someone in the audience who is just a layman first aider or from even the person who's delivering it. And there's also always an opportunity to enhance what's been happening in that classroom if you can do it from a place of humility. So there's a lot to be discussed from this question. But the reason why I say it's a little bit overthought is because there's nothing actually wrong with a paramedic, a nurse, a student nurse, a student paramedic, or even just a, you know, general public accompanying one of these field teams if they have a valid first aid certificate. And if they're performing under a first aid role, anyone can do it. Now, the irony is, if I am operating as a first aider and there is something in front of me that I have some more skills to offer, there's actually nothing wrong with me practicing at that level either if the equipment is available to me. That's only if you've been trained. So there is a little bit of gray area here around this person being a student paramedic. They're not yet registered. So what they would need to fall under, and I mean, you could take this to emergency law, Michael Eburn. I'm sure he would have a lot to offer here. But I would say that this person, because they're still a student, would have to fall back on, I'm the team first aider. And I would encourage them to do an advanced first aid certificate, an advanced resus certificate, so they can actually practice at a higher first aid level. There's a lot of first aiders issuing things like methoxyfluorine to people.
So this is a question around, as a student paramedic who is going and working in an alternative role as part of, say, a field research team.
And part of what they used to do.
Yeah. How do they, as a student paramedic, do so?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I would encourage anyone, student or registered paramedic, to get out there and actually apply their skills in just about any environment that is offered, because you will always learn things. The thing with operating as a first aider is you've actually got to think sometimes really quickly on your feet, because you don't have access to the same gear. You don't have access to the same equipment. And often you're actually limited significantly by the resources that you have. And so there's actually a lot of adaptation required, or there's a lot of improvisation required. And if you can learn to adapt and improvise things from limited resources, you can actually practice at a much higher level to support someone. It's still from a first aid place.
Interesting.
So it's an interesting question, because it poses a lot. So interestingly, in the letter, one of the things that he actually references is the first aid kit consisted of several Band-Aids, a PLB, and not much else, so it would be very difficult to make things worse. And look, that's true. We often say bad first aid is better than no first aid. Mm. But when we actually operate at a higher clinical level, we also are very aware that sometimes it's good to sit on your hands and actually observe what's going on.
How do you think, though, that we can operate with, you know, less gear and less support and be comfortable with the fact that we may not be able to address things to the standard that we are used to? And how can we be comfortable with that when we're going out to these remote locations?
But where's that standard come from is the first question I'd pose back. Mm. It always comes from the foundation of where you were taught. So one of the things that challenges a lot of professional paramedics, I'm not even the students, I'm talking about professional paramedics. What challenges them is the notion that you can still practice as a paramedic without S8s. And it's because all of them have grown up with S8s. I'm sure, Lou, you're going through a lot of exams at the moment. Mm. You've gone through a lot of pharmacological exams. Mm-hmm. You've got to know how to use S8s. What are the S8s that you've been quizzed on?
Fentanyl, morphine.
Yep. Has other things come into it? Have you discussed things like ketamine, or have you discussed things like, even S4s like methoxy?
Yeah, definitely S4s. Yep. Even just your simple Panadol, Nurofen.
Now,
but are the drugs that you're being assessed on based on a jurisdictional ambulance status?
Yes.
And this, again, this is the foundation of where paramedicine has come from. But this is what creates some of that confusion around these roles is, again, you can registered nurses have become really good at taking their skills outside of the hospital in the last 20 years. And that's why they are literally flying everywhere with their RFDS. That's why they're in just about every private school that needs medical professionals.
Why do you think that is? Why do you think that is? That they've progressed quicker in that space than paramedics?
Nursing is also an older profession than ambulance and paramedicine, mm-hmm. right? You can particularly in Australia, you can reference when the first ambulances actually started. Mm. And it was literally horse-drawn carts and people carrying stretchers. But long before that was established, there were nurses in hospitals assisting doctors. So it's a much older profession and they've had a lot more time to structure things. What we learned during that time, and I mean, this is some trendsetting and trailblazing nurses and doctors, recognize it by taking the skills outside and onto the street will actually influence and impact outcomes sometimes better, sometimes worse, we're learning. But I think it's just historically they've had a lot longer to establish themselves. And this is why, particularly from an Australian reference, national registration 2018 was celebrated as like the end of a long journey. And I saw it as something different. It was actually the beginning of a much larger journey. Because although we might be a registered profession, we're not acting professional yet. And I'm not saying that to disparage the profession, but where all of our education and 99% of our educators are coming from ambulance who haven't worked outside of that, it exposes a vulnerability in our own educational structure. And unfortunately, we still lack the humility and the behavior required to actually acknowledge a vulnerability. If you can acknowledge a vulnerability, it's actually an asset. It's actually a strength. It's not a weakness at all, but people perceive it as a weakness. And so the way you mask that is you stomp on those differences and you don't acknowledge them. So, you know, to go back to the question in the letter, the question involves how can I operate in this environment, you know, legally and ethically? Look, as a student, you're going to be going as a first aider because you don't have anything else to benchmark yourself against. But once you're a registered paramedic, you can work as a registered paramedic in a lot of different roles and you don't need an ambulance kit to do so. I've worked as a registered paramedic sometimes with such limited gear, it actually wouldn't be that much different from what Laura? Laura is describing here, a couple band-aids and a PLB. Yeah.
Thing is, there's no definition of what a paramedic should carry, whether it's gear, drugs, skills. There's nothing out there within at least Australia. So there's no standard. So there's this kind of mentality that anything but what you would expect to see from a jurisdictional ambulance, anything less than that isn't good enough and you're not providing the interventions that a paramedic should be able to provide. And I think that's a very unfounded statement because there's nothing out there. There is no standard. It can be whatever you want it to be.
Well, interestingly, if there is some kind of incident on the street and the public are flapping around, because, I mean, that's what people do, right? That's why you have professional people to come in and manage it. If people are flapping around and someone steps up and says, I'm a doctor, people normally go, great, thank you for being here. No one says, hold on, where's your gear? Right? Now, put that same scenario with a paramedic. Someone steps up and says, I'm a paramedic. The public go, great. That's awesome. They don't say, where's your gear? Mm-hmm. The irony is, I have yet to see a doctor criticize a doctor in a public space without gear. But I consistently see paramedics ridicule each other who are working in this space without gear. And I find that somewhat ironic because if we can't respect ourselves working in areas that have limited gear, no one will. So we've got to get comfortable with ourselves. Like I said, a couple of band-aids and a PLB, I've literally worked as a professional paramedic in roles that literally have that. But I've got a lot of clinical knowledge and a lot of experience that I can bring to the table. And let's face it, half of what we do is actually non-clinical. It's reassuring, it's communicating, and it's managing.
Yeah.
So you can act as a professional paramedic in so many different roles if you can unstitch yourself away from, I need to carry certain things that define me. Now, having those things obviously makes a job much better. And, you know, the more skills and more equipment we have obviously professionalize what we're doing. But I've seen professional paramedics at a multicas incident, and there were obviously far more patients than they could manage. And because one of them had the cardiac monitor, the other one, for lack of a better phrase, essentially had a bit of a meltdown because they didn't know how to assess a patient without a cardiac monitor. And we arrived and it kind of floored me a little bit because we should be masters at things like a perfusion status assessment, a respiratory status assessment, basic vital signs. I can literally look at Lou right now and perform a pupillary assessment on her if I need to.
Lou is well perfused.
she's well perfused.
Pink, warm and dry.
And but I think because we've had such a emphasis on clinical, 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 people think that is what defines a profession. And I think that's a misnomer. So to answer Laura's question here, I think, look, as a student, you're going to operate as a first aider and you're safe and do as many first aid courses as you can, because I'm still learning things from first aid. I think actually historically paramedics are bad at first aid too.
But can I just interject and say Laura is in such an amazing position where she already is starting to learn so much about the body and the body systems. She can provide reassurance to people knowing. Exactly. So she's in a fantastic position. Although she's not a registered paramedic, she already has such great knowledge.
What I also like about this is you're right, in a very good position here. They're in a very good position because they're already thinking differently mm-hmm. to the old guard. Now, Nick, you and I are part of the old guard.
Yes, we are.
There's an older guard than us, but we've certainly come through the old guard. And I'm seeing this more and more and more and more where the next generation, right, the ones who are surrounding Lou, they're looking at the profession differently and they're acting differently and they're asking such good questions. Mm-hmm. Any question that we don't know how to answer is a fantastic question because it's going to enhance the profession. And this is one of those. This is one of those questions.
The only bad question is the one you don't ask.
There we go.
Hey, Lou, what did Laura have for you?
Laura wanted
to... That kind of rhymed.
Wait, say it again.
Hey, Lou, what did Laura have for you?
Oh, my gosh.
It did.
So many things rhyme with my name.
Like what?
Ooh, you just, do.
That's Ooh. The one I got to. I apologize for putting this out there.
Crew?
Crew. Crew. I like crew.
People think my name's Rue on the phone when Rue? I call up and like order things and they're like, Rue?
Okay. Louise. My name's Louise.
I was going to say, I've known you a long time. Mm. Yes. I've never known anyone to call you Louise.
Yes.
Do you only get called Louise when you're in trouble? Like Stephen when he's in trouble?
Yes.
Or Nicholas when I'm in trouble?
Yes.
Nicholas.
Nicholas. Stephen and Nick. Stephen, Nicholas and Louise. Welcome.
Welcome to our podcast. Stephen, Nicholas and Louise.
It just sounds too official. Sorry. I got just very distracted. Laura wanted to know, if I am concerned about my career in paramedicine and how it's going to affect me physically and mentally, and I imagine Laura's speaking about, you know, the jobs that you go to, but also the shift work and the stress that comes with, you know, dealing with the public at, you know, probably their worst day. So I think that's a great question, is if I'm concerned about my future. I mean, I wouldn't say I'm concerned, but I would say it's something that I have thought heavily about. And so instead
Does that not mean you're concerned?
No, I'm just planning.
What's on your mind about it?
Being proactive as opposed to reactive. I suppose I have gone on a few clinical placements now and I have seen paramedics who are quite negative. And so when I delved a little bit deeper and learned a little bit more about these paramedics, I found that for their career, their working career as a paramedic, all they had done was worked in a jurisdictional ambulance service. So I started to see a trend with paramedics in that the ones that, the ones that weren't really happy had really have not done anything else. They had dedicated their entire life to paramedicine. They also probably had a poor attitude about it and didn't like where paramedicine was progressing in that a lot of the jobs were now low acuity.
Which is half the job.
I know. It's the best part.
In the private sector, that's a lot of the job.
Yeah.
I was going to say, is a long period of time in paramedicine going to make you negative, or is a long period of time in any job going to make you negative?
Oh, I just think neither.
Neither. I think it's the person.
It's the attitude. It's the attitude. Because I have met some great paramedics that have been doing this for 20, 30 years.
That's what I was going to say.
And they love it.
Awesome career paramedics.
So I think it comes down to definitely your attitude, but also maybe trying some different things.
Do you think they feel trapped? Or do you think...
The golden handcuffs.
Well, you referenced the golden handcuffs today.
I think Laura referenced them, did she not?
That's where it came from.
Yes, Laura referenced
them. Golden handcuffs.
And I honestly didn't know what it meant.
Yeah.
Now, I know that probably there's some listeners going, what? it. But I honestly, I've heard it referenced before, but I had no idea the context. Can you explain it to me again?
I'll try my best. I'm sorry if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that you're trapped somewhere that is considered a really ideal job, but you're still trapped. So, for instance, a lot of people love jurisdictional ambulance services and they feel like they are chained to that job, but it's a really good job. So they're handcuffed to that particular job.
But they're golden.
But it's a good job, you know?
That is a good definition.
Is that how you define that?
Nick, is this a good job?
It's a fantastic job. Mm. I think people get trapped because it pays really well.
And never used to.
Sorry?
It never used to.
Never used to. But now it pays very well and people get a certain lifestyle with that paycheck and they don't want to leave because then they have to change their lifestyle. So if they're going to have to take a pay cut to go and study again or to take a different job or to change their career or pivot in paramedicine, they don't want to lose the money because the money brings them a lifestyle that makes them happy, that compensates for their negativity at work.
And
so if they can go to Europe 3 times a year and drive a BMW, they can't have that anymore.
Can I just, if you are in paramedicine for the money, I think you're doomed to fail.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I agree.
Now, I've never been a money-orientated person.
But if you're in any job for money, though.
No, not at all, mate. There's plenty of other jobs I could do for money, and I'd do be doing them.
Yeah, but there's money, there's money. If you could do any job for a few million dollars a year, but...
But I was doing the work of a paramedic because I enjoyed it. Mm-hmm. Now, what did I enjoy? I've actually had to unpack this through my own career and actually acknowledge certain truths that made me reasonably uncomfortable. But so many, and I used to use this in first year classes too, so many people say, well, because I like to help people.
Mm.
The irony of that statement is a lot of us like to help people because it makes us feel good. So I'm actually doing it not to help, I'm doing it because it makes me feel good, important, and needed.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
So, I mean, we can unpack that in a whole nother podcast, but I never joined the profession to make lots of money. And I never fell in this trap either. I used to see a lot of my colleagues in a number of the jurisdictional ambulances I've worked for over my career chasing overtime like it is just a necessity that's going to define them. And I would never chase overtime because I love my days off. I love surfing. I love climbing. I'll do anything else except work on my days off. And I refuse to be addicted to money. Now, I've struggled financially and I can't go to Europe 3 times a year. I can't go once a year. But if you're a paramedic for the money, you're doomed to fail.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that might be the people that you're referring to, Lou, is exactly what Nick referenced, is it is a good job these days. It comes with status and it is incredibly well paid. I actually found one of my first pay slips, Nick, from when we met nearly 15 years ago. Do you know how much we were on a year back then?
Remind me.
Now, this was good money.
I remember getting 80 grand.
Oh, going, you did wow. You did bulk overtime. I had 66,000 for the year.
Wow.
Right now, most paramedics are on 160 sometimes. So a significant change. But that is also what might cause some of these career paramedics who maybe should have gone or want to go to stay. And that is going to be very... Well, it's going to have some very poor effects on their mental health, on their physical health, and on their attitude.
Yes.
Which, are you concerned about this with your career? Because that's the question from Laura.
Yeah, I am not, but I think that's because I have thought about it. But maybe I am concerned, and that's why I've thought about it.
Are you concerned about becoming negative?
Yeah.
Or are you concerned about your mental health or your physical health?
Well, I self-reflect a lot. So when I've been on placement and I see all these other people that are quite negative, I like to ask myself why and how I can prevent myself from becoming like that. And I've realized that it's just a lot to do with your attitude. So
have you heard a quote?
I've heard many.
There's a pretty, great quote.
Pretty open-ended.
I know.
called, "Show me your friends and I'll show you your future." You heard that quote?
I think so, yeah.
I heard this last
week. It's like...
From Nick.
You lie with dogs, you get fleas, right?
Oh my God.
Writing that down.
Yeah, mine's better.
Okay, I got another one.
Oh. Birds of a feather?
No.
Oh.
Kids.
It's hard to be a flower amongst the thorns, but it's also hard to be a thorn amongst the flowers.
Do you know that's my last name?
Thorn.
I'm a thorn.
I was going to say she's not Lou Flower. This is so awkward.
What?
maybe Sorry. They weren't the negative one. Maybe. No, I'm joking. Can I?
One.
What does that mean?
Which one?
The first one.
Which one? Birds of a feather?
Show me your friends and I'll show you your future.
Well, if you're going to surround with a bunch of people who are negative, you're just going to start to experience that and feel negative yourself.
Your the attitudes,
way of putting it.
Values and beliefs are heavily influenced by that of the people closest to you and those that surround you. So if that is negative and dismissive and unimaginative attitudes and beliefs of the groups and the people that you spend time with, whether that's your friends or your colleagues or your family or people on social media, that is where you will navigate. It'll influence your values and beliefs. So sometimes I think we get echo chambers, and especially younger staff, they want to fit in. We're tribal people. We're social people. We want to fit into the tribe of our workplace. So it's easy to slip in when we're trying to fit in.
Yes.
And it's hard to challenge a group mentality.
It can be hard.
But what you can do to control it is to look inwards and go, who are my friends? Who are those people around me? And if I don't align with their values, beliefs, and behaviors, then I need to go find someone who does.
Absolutely.
See, I don't think this is a jurisdictional ambulance problem. Mm. I think it's an institutional problem because these people can't see a way out. Mm. You know, I've worked with some of the most amazing people on the planet. And like I said, they've been in jurisdictional ambulance services forever. You know, like one of my best mates has been an ambulance paramedic for 35 years and he's one of the most positive people. He's one of the best educators. And he still thrives in it. Mm. And it's interesting because I even reflect on my own journey and I know I fatigued on it, you know, and we've spoken to people who have also recognized fatigue and burnout. Some keep going, some pivot. I certainly pivoted because I didn't want to fall in that trap. But the irony of that word is I never felt trapped.
Mm.
And I think it's because of the people who were around me as well. So it's interesting, Nick, because I can actually take a lot out of that. Mm. What are you looking forward to though, Lou, in this job? Because let me spell this job out to you. Long hours sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Trauma. Now, people sometimes say, what's the worst thing you've ever seen? And they're expecting some kind of mangled wreck. And it's actually, for me, it was transporting kids with terminal illness, right? So there's trauma, whether that be physical or mental, who knows what. There's missed meals.
Mm-hmm.
There's extensions to shifts. There's long periods of time away from home.
You're not painting a very good picture.
But
at
Nick
all.
Said, and I would agree, that it is one of the best jobs in the world.
Mm.
What are you looking forward to? Let's talk about some of the
best job I ever had.
There we go. Oh. Positive things.
Nick worked at Subway.
That was a good job. I had so many meatball subs.
Not as good as paramedicine?
I made $8.90 an hour.
Wow.
I thought I was king.
Big spender. That's
paramedicine, best job in the world.
What are you looking forward to?
That is a great question. And I don't know how to answer it, if I'm honest. I think I'm looking forward to the challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Being challenged. I really like talking to people as well and community. I find people are fascinating. And I think that's why I've gone into a job where a big part of it is just talking. Really, like
it's a social job.
It's a social job.
And you've got to build relationships quickly and then lose them instantly.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you say the wrong thing.
Well, no, when I say lose them instantly, once you've handed that patient on,
I know.
You actually need to reset and go build a new friend.
Sometimes that's the saddest thing when you have to say goodbye.
That is one of the traumatic things too. We also don't know the outcomes of whatever we've just handed over.
That's very true. Yeah. So, yeah, I think, the challenge, the social side of it, I mean, I want to say you do get to help people. I feel like we always fall back onto that as well. That's probably initially why I got into it. And then I realized, wow, this is such a diverse job. You get to see so much. And
there's two kinds of people in the world, Lou. There's those who see someone fall over and laugh, and there's those who see someone fall over and put their hand to help them up. You are one of the people who puts a hand down to help them up. I fall in between both.
Yeah, I could
say
that.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
You laughed at me the other day.
He's carrying some boxes and fell over.
He pushed me.
Nick.
You're next.
You had a letter.
I had a letter from Laura. Thank you, Laura, for writing these. These are fantastic. Mm. Laura was talking about patients who refuse care, and they use the context of patients in pain. Something that they've seen out on placement was this mentality that if a patient refused paracetamol, therefore they don't have pain. Yes.
Wait, what?
A theme they were seeing was where patient would be in pain, they refused paracetamol, and then the assumption was that, well, their pain can't be that bad. No. Let's not give them anything further. So the question went on to say, where do you feel your responsibility lies in responding to patients that refuse care, and do you have an obligation to change their mind?
That's a really good question.
Now, the first concept of if a patient refused paracetamol, therefore they don't have pain, I think that's absolute crap, to be brutally honest with you. The first question I would ask is, if a patient has pain and they're refusing something like paracetamol, rather than assuming that they don't have pain, maybe ask why don't they want the Panadol, why they don't want to take it. Sometimes they're in so much pain they don't want to swallow a tablet. But also, they may not think it's going to work. But we know that things like simple paracetamol, and maybe we shouldn't call it simple analgesia anymore because that degrades the effectiveness it can have. But things like paracetamol have a really great synergistic effect with other medicines like ibuprofen or S8s like morphine and fentanyl. So patients who get paracetamol plus opiates, we know need less opiates in ED. And they even reckon that Nurofen plus paracetamol together can give you the equivalent analgesia of 5 milligrams of Endone. So paracetamol isn't really simple. It's an effective pain relief. And if our patients are refusing it, the first question we should ask is why? Why do they not want it? Or maybe we should be asking ourselves, have we explained it properly to the patient?
That's actually a really good point, because sometimes there are paramedics that have failed to build rapport, trust, a relationship with them. And so I would be less inclined to sometimes take perceived assistance from those people. But there are also those people that have built a relationship and then haven't explained it properly. And then there are also a lot of other complicated reasons that we could potentially just get curious about. And if the patient's not forthcoming, acceptance. Well, look, the offer's there. And then potentially offer something else.
I think there's an elephant in the room that we don't talk about enough, and that's health literacy. I think paramedics have a huge responsibility in engaging with patients that refuse care, because I think sometimes we forget how privileged we are to have the health literacy that we do. We spend years and years and years learning about the human body, about how it functions normally, about disease processes and how to manage those in both acute and chronic settings. And the general public does not have this level of education. The general public, even in Australia, even in well-educated people, lawyers and bankers and accountants, their health literacy is generally poor. So if they don't have the information to make an informed decision, it's not unreasonable to think that sometimes the decision they make might be different to ours, because we have the privilege of the education. So it's our responsibility as paramedics to make sure that we inform our patients correctly of the information surrounding the advice that we're giving. So if a patient's refusing something that we're recommending, the first question should be why, and have I explained it to them properly? Because in my experience, there's a very, very few patients who truly refuse care. It's because we haven't explained it to them properly.
You're making this a me problem. It's a patient problem.
100%. Because sometimes it's like, do you want to go to hospital? No. Mm. Rather than going, okay, you might die. Bye. Mm. Maybe you go, why don't you want to go to hospital? Oh, because my dog's here and who's going to feed it in the morning?
Problem solve.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go to your neighbor. Can they come? Can we ring someone? Can we organize something for you? Find solutions to the barriers and then we'll have something else. The other thing is sometimes people don't know what they need when they're incredibly stressed, when they're in a crisis situation. Because remember, a lot of the time when people call for assistance for healthcare, they're having a really bad day. And their brain, their prefrontal cortex that makes good decisions, that can process information in a methodical and accurate way, it's not working properly. And that's why they call upon healthcare professionals to help them through their crisis. So we can't expect patients to be able to make fantastic decisions in a crisis. We need to make sure we're doing the best thing by them by making sure that when they refuse care, they're being informed appropriately.
I think you answered that perfectly.
There's a lot you can unpack from it because capacity obviously comes into that and affects both sides of the equation, assessing whether that patient has the capacity to understand what's occurring, what's been said, but not only capacity from the patient's perspective. We so often assume capacity is for the patient. I'm also talking about the capacity of the paramedic in the context of what you're talking about to understand the perspective of the patient, the situation that their patient's in. And it's tricky because there's some paramedics who will go to 12 jobs a shift. There's other paramedics who will go to 12 jobs a year. And neither one of those are going to be better or worse, but it is, you know, one is fatiguing, one is lacking exposure. But it is capacity on both sides of the equation that I think make it rather complex.
The second part of Laura's question was, do you have an obligation to try and change their mind? You have an obligation to make sure you inform them correctly.
Yeah, the changing
of minds. We don't coerce.
We don't coerce.
We do not coerce.
What's the difference between coerce and encourage?
One spelt differently.
Encourage and coerce, because we can encourage people down a path, but we cannot coerce them.
Thank you, Laura, for all the questions.
Thank you so much. I am going to frame this.
This is our first
going in the pool room.
Written letter from Laura.
Nick, mine was 2 pages.
Mine was 2 pages.
Okay, well, I've just found another question.
Oh, go. What? I was going to play some outro music, but sure.
Where's your other question?
How do you ethically take on medical responsibility for teams in remote areas, knowing that there are so many issues that you would be unable to manage given the environmental and resource limitations?
Ooh.
I'm not sure if there is a right answer, and I suspect much of your responsibility is in preparing everyone for the trip, both physically and in the setting of expectations, but I am just curious. So how do you ethically take on the medical responsibility of a team, knowing that there's so many issues that you might not be able to manage? I actually think that they just answered the question for themselves, because preparation is actually key, and sometimes it's dynamic, sometimes it's actually there's time. But I don't believe we can take on the entire responsibility for anything, whether we're in an ambulance or whether we're in a remote field context. I think acceptance of where we live and operate must come into play. But the notion of taking on all the responsibility is a bit of a misnomer for me, because I take on some of the responsibility that I may or may not be able to help, but also preparing the team for you may or may not receive care, you may or may not receive care at a certain level is, I think, a part of just practicing.
So also coming back to informing your patient, you're also informing your team of the standard.
And that's also how I mentally prepare for these things. I mean, working in a metropolitan ambulance service is no different for me than working in a remote area, because even in a metropolitan ambulance, there's only so many things we can do.
Mm, exactly.
There are a lot of more, there's a lot more resources,
mm-hmm.
But there's only so many things we can do. And that's why people are historically transported to hospital where the care can be potentially given.
Yes.
But even there's limitations.
Yes.
If you are out in the middle of nowhere and you need a specialist surgery, you're just not going to get it. Sometimes we just need to accept that people have adverse outcomes that are preventable if they were in a different time or place.
I think that's what we forget, is ultimately people are going to die sometimes, and that is a natural part of existing.
Mm.
Oh, that's a really, it's kind of sad note to finish on. Give me something happy.
I can give you some music.
No, I want something happy from Lou.
Or
maybe some music.
Yeah.
Okay. Is this the Laura song?
Yeah, man. Ready?
It is.
It's a good song to finish.
It's a bad one.
Yeah, there it is.
It's quite an upbeat song. But
I want a song about Louise.
Yeah.
I want a song about Stephen.
I want
Stephen.
Louise Thorne.
Louise Thorne.
That's the end of season
three?
Four.
That's the end of season three.
End of season three.
We're going to take a short break before we come back for season four, but we're moving into conference season.
Conference season.
We are.
We had a sold-out conference recently.
We did.
The first time it was
Respond 25.
What'd you think, Lou? Was it fun?
Very fun.
There were 180 people.
Oh, my God. And 14 speakers.
You want to sing along? They got lyrics.
No. We're running Respond 2026. Dates to be released soon. Tickets on sale soon.
Good band, Vaudeville Smash, Melbourne-based band. They come to Brisbane. Next time they come, we could go.
By them. Just
they should. They should play at Respond 26.
Oh my god!
Just because you like certain music doesn't mean I'm a fan.
You can't hate this song.
It's pretty catchy. I'm walking out.
We lost Sunny. Sunny's gone.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for season three. We'll see you next year. Thanks, Laura, for the amazing letter. Got any questions, qualms, queries, concerns, please reach out to us. You can write us an email at hello@theshiftextension.org, or you can write us a letter. But until next time, see you later.
See you later.